You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, May 15th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Youssef Manayer, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, on Gaza, Nakba, and the American Embassy. Also on the program today, Trump helps Chinese phone maker in a naked quid pro quo.
Be cool.
The EPA quashes a national water contamination study because why not? Amazon bigfoots a Seattle tax increase, and it's primary day in Pennsylvania, Idaho, Nebraska, and Oregon. Go vote. Meanwhile, Trump aides claim Pence is coming for the king. The podcast patent troll is officially dead 5 years later. And another Democrat comes out for Gina Haspel. Muqtada al-Sadr wins big in Iraq. Somewhere, Steve Gillard is laughing, probably not necessarily happily. Ebola is spreading in the Congo, and the U.S. no longer has a chief monitoring such diseases. Yeah. And with Lula in jail, fascists leading Brazil elections, all this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, just following the really horrific news out of Israel and the juxtaposition of now over 60 people being killed, 90 in the past, 3 weeks, over 1,000 injured, and the sort of images coming out of the embassy as if it was the royal palace. And we will talk to Youssef Manayer about that. And I would also say this. May 15th is the date of what Palestinians refer to as Nakba. We'll talk about that with Youssef. It doesn't, most Americans are not terribly familiar with the term. It translates loosely into the catastrophe. It is the day that is marked when Palestinians were driven from their homes in the course of who would become Israelis, I guess, cleansing them from areas around Jerusalem and other areas in what ultimately became Israel. There's not a lot of history of this that is available to us in the United States because people have not chose to highlight that history. However, if you go back to the February 11th, 2013 interview I did with Benny Bruner on his documentary called The Great Book Robbery, you can look at, I think this, the Great Book Robbery is probably online, if not on YouTube, certainly somewhere for free. And it details just one slice of what took place at that time. But the idea being that we hear a lot that there was no Palestinian culture. There was no Palestinian society that existed there. It was as if there was just a bunch of Bedouins in the desert. And that is not the case. And
I mean, even if it were, that would not be a justification.
No. But the, you know, a lot of people argue that, well, there's no right of return because there was really no there there. And it is worth looking up this film, watching it, The Great Book Robbery, because it's about, frankly, the books and the libraries that that people had in that region. And you can learn a lot more about the actual society that did exist there. I don't know if there's like some human... I don't know if there's... to get into arguments about that, it inevitably evolves around like, there are no such thing as Palestinians. They don't exist. They're Jordanians or they're this. No, there in fact was a, if not a recognized country per se, although it was Palestine. But there certainly was a nationality, if you will. Or so check that out. And we will get to Yousef shortly. We should probably just show you some footage of what has been going on there. Now, the story that the White House has been telling, and we'll talk to Yousef more about this, but the story that the White House has been telling is that there was, the Israelis had reason to believe that hundreds of thousands of Hamas-encouraged Palestinians were amassing on the border and were ready to, I guess, charge the fences. And there seems to be zero evidence of that. Were there people there protesting? Yes, as there had been for weeks. Were there more? Maybe. I don't know. A couple thousand?
Some of those people had slingshots, all right?
Yeah. We actually also, I think, do we have an image of one guy with a slingshot from his wheelchair? He had lost his legs, I guess, at a... do we have that picture? We never pulled it. And yeah, here it is. And it's unclear to me what this guy's name was, because I've seen two different names attributed to him. He was shot. As you can see him throwing that slingshot. He has no legs. So probably not a huge threat to the state of Israel with that slingshot there. There was a baby, 8 months old, who was killed. Here are pictures of IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, so-called, firing tear gas at Palestinian protesters with the use of a drone. So there's the drone right there, you can see. And then they drop tear gas canisters, just dropping down on people like, well, they also function as bombs. But I mean, I you know, I'm not great with crowd numbers, but we're looking at 1,000 people, maybe. And if they were, of course, crashing the fences, then you wouldn't need a drone to drop the tear gas on them. You'd be able to throw it at them. Let's play the... here is a video of Nikki Haley, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. This is on Today. That the relocation of the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv was not to blame for the deadly... Well, let's listen to what she has to say. I mean, it is the case that there have been protesters there for weeks because for years they have been suffering all sorts of deprivation, running from food shortages to unemployment that I think is almost incalculable. I mean, it's almost easier to calculate employment than it is unemployment there.
Right.
Because it's smaller number, the employment.
And lack of medical supplies even. I mean, even David Cameron, just this point of like global comparison of how everybody else understands this issue, called it an open air prison and said it was unacceptable.
And we'll talk to Youssef Munayyer about the implications of the embassy. But that basically was the U.S. signal to the Israelis that like anything goes. But here is Nikki Haley blaming Hamas for the violence, I guess. I don't know how that works.
But let's remember that the Hamas terrorist organization has been inciting violence for years, long before the United States decided to move our embassy. In recent days, multiple news organizations have documented the Hamas incitement in Gaza. They have reported that Hamas maps and social media show the fastest routes to reach Israeli communities in case demonstrators make it through the security fence. They have reported on Hamas messages over loudspeakers that urge demonstrators to burst through the fence, falsely claiming Israeli soldiers were fleeing, when in fact they were not. The same loudspeakers are used by Hamas to urge the crowds to, quote, get closer to the security fence. Hamas has attacked the Kerem Shalom crossing, the biggest entry point in Gaza, for fuel, food, and medical supplies. This is how determined they are to make the lives of the Palestinian people miserable. They light Molotov cocktails attached to kites on fire and attempt to fly them into Israel to cause as much destruction as possible. When asked yesterday why he put a swastika on his burning kite, the terrorist responded, quote, "The Jews go crazy when you mention Hitler," unquote. This is what is endangering the people of Gaza. Make no mistake, Hamas is pleased with the results from yesterday. I asked my colleagues here in the Security Council, who among us would accept this type of activity on your border? No one would. No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has.
Oh, my God. So let me see if I get this straight. The terrorists are using kites to threaten this country. Kites and megaphones. And the Israelis are using sniper fire and drones. And I mean, it's just, it's absurd on its face. It's absurd on its face. I can't believe she's even able to deliver that stuff without sort of cracking up.
Honestly, just say we support Israeli apartheid and rampant abuses at all times. I mean, because that's just slingshots and bullhorns. I mean, how could you?
She's literally saying the terrorist wrote a mean thing on the kite, ladies and gentlemen.
Super triggering, and that's why over 60 people needed to be slaughtered protesting their
imprisonment. Just imagine, triggering. Just imagine if the 1,000 Mexican people lined up on the border of Texas and Mexico and had a kite that said "Dirty Gringo." Can you imagine?
Well, now that you say that, I would say we would need to obviously slaughter and massacre all of those Mexicans. I mean, I think that's a given. But here's the other thought experiment I'd like to run.
Damn Yankee!
Could you imagine if we were in a historical situation where there was a community of Jewish people in Gaza and the West Bank that were controlled by and occupied by a military and expansionist settlers in the West Bank and in Gaza couldn't get medical supplies and were killed with impunity at any time the occupying government wanted? That would be rightfully a global crisis of anti-Semitism.
A neighborhood in Warsaw.
Exactly.
And then they started flying kites over and saying stuff like, dirty kraut.
When you make fun of Hitler's mustache, we get upset. This is what the Jewish leadership wanted. We would have no desire to do this.
I also would say, I just want to also add that, you know, South Africa, whatever the flaws in government, the ANC is still the ANC and the Party of Liberation. They withdrew their ambassador and people should note that.
Sinn Féin has called for it in Ireland, too.
Yeah, and people should also know that Desmond Tutu, Ronnie Caswells, everybody said it's the same situation.
All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Youssef Munayyer. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Pleasure to welcome, I believe, back to the program, Youssef Munayyer. He is the executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Youssef, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with what's going on and has been ongoing in Gaza. Really now for over a decade. And then let's lead up to what's been happening over the past couple of months. And then we will get more, we will close that window as we go. But for folks who do not understand, and when they hear the claim that Gaza has had self-determination since, I guess it was 2005, when there was a fairly rushed election, certainly promoted by the United States with the hopes, I think, that perhaps Hamas would not prevail. But tell us what the situation in Gaza has actually been like since that time.
Right. So to kind of set the scene, Gaza is a tiny piece of land. That today is where over 2 million people live. It is one of the most densely populated places on Earth, particularly the refugee camps. The vast majority of the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, upwards of 80%, are not originally from Gaza, even though Gaza itself is a millennia-old civilized place, but most of them were refugees from towns and villages around what is today the Gaza Strip, who were forced out of their homes and denied return to their homes by the State of Israel in 1948. And of course, in 1967, the Israeli state occupied the Gaza Strip along with the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and other Arab territories, and continues to effectively occupy the Gaza Strip to this day. And now, as you point out, there is a misconception around the status of the Gaza Strip, because in 2005, the Israelis withdrew their settlers from the Gaza Strip, but they continued to control it from the outside. They continue to control who gets in and out, along with what gets in and out, which has had a devastating impact on the economy of the Gaza Strip. And today you have massive unemployment, particularly youth unemployment. You have devastating humanitarian conditions where you have a dramatic lack of electricity. You have almost 96% of the water being unfit for human consumption. And of course, because those are very central utilities to everything else in life, many other things that are basic in modern life do not function well either, including sewage, including hospital facilities, including so many other things. And so, you know, the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip first experienced ethnic cleansing, became refugees, then became subject to a military occupation, and since 2005 have been subject to policies of siege that have strangled the economy of the Strip and really effectively, collectively punished 2 million people there, regardless to political affiliation, regardless to activity, regardless to age or gender. It's an all-encompassing siege. And so what we've been seeing over the last several weeks is Palestinians in the Gaza Strip protesting to end all of these injustices, to end the policies of the siege, to allow for a genuine opportunity for Palestinian self-determination, and for a right for Palestinian refugees from Gaza to return to the towns and villages that they are from, that they are denied to return from, simply because they're not Jewish, because that is how the state of Israel defines the refugee population as infiltrators, because they are not Jewish. And the state of Israel has responded to these protests in a very brutal way. And of course, we have seen the fruits of that response on display most recently yesterday, when about 60 Palestinians were killed in the protest by Israeli military snipers who were given orders to shoot at Palestinians and use lethal force if they approached close to the fence where Israel closes in the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And this order, it should be made clear, is a clear contravention of international law, where the use of lethal force is to be reserved only for imminent threats to life. And with the, you know, Israeli state making clear that they're shooting anyone who approaches a fence, it's pretty clear that it doesn't meet that standard.
Now, you
so you had yesterday... Yeah.
Well, I'll work our way up to yesterday in a moment.
Sure.
But and for those people who in some respects, like, I don't even know why it's even relevant to ask this question. No one would ever say that the American public should be punished because Donald Trump is our elected leader. And God knows what he is capable of doing, what he may do in the future in terms of harming other people. Never mind what he's doing, let's say, on the immigration front, right? You know, and no one would ever argue that the American public should be punished by some other power because Donald Trump is our president. But for those people who suggest that the problem is Hamas just by their very nature in their existence, you know, give us a sense of what Hamas has done and continues to do or doesn't do, and what position they hold in terms of Israel or do not hold, supposedly justifies whatever befalls these other 2 million people.
So Hamas is one of many different Palestinian political parties that span the political spectrum among Palestinians. Today, they don't have significant support among Palestinians. In fact, no particular party has majority support among Palestinians because they are disillusioned with leaders who have promised to advance their cause in one way or another, but have failed to deliver. And in fact, most Palestinians don't support any particular party. The largest single percentage of Palestinians support none of the above. I do think, though, it's important to make clear that the grievances of Palestinians that are expressed in these protests are grievances that are supported by Palestinians across the board, because these are basic rights. And so there are, of course, going to be people who are Palestinian and maybe Hamas supporters who are supporters of this protest. But there are also many, many other people who are not Hamas supporters, but are supporters of these protests as well, because they are Palestinian. And this is about the basic rights of Palestinians. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. And look, you know, the Israeli sort of PR strategy in response to, the international outrage over the shooting of protesters has been to just kind of scream Hamas at everything. But the reality is, as we've seen on video time and again, that many of these people are being shot while standing around doing nothing. They're being shot by bullets that come from guns that are held by the Israeli military, that are paid for, by the way, by you and me and millions of other American taxpayers who are financing the Israeli military and enabling these massacres. And they're firing those rifles on the orders of the Israeli state. And so, you know, we need to be really clear about responsibility here, because the guns don't shoot themselves, right? I mean, these people are acting on orders to shoot protesters. I think in any other context around the world, we would immediately recognize that for what it is and not really give any credence to, you know, the excuses that those who perpetrated these massacres attempt to put forward.
Let's talk, since we're touching on the use of U.S. military weapons. I know that you have been one of the people, one of the organizations that has been pushing for the U.S. Congress to pass, or I guess to pay attention to legislation on some level, as to how U.S. made weapons are and are not to be used in once they've been sold. Just outline that for us, what the theory is and what kind of legislation you're looking for.
Sure. Well, look, first, there are already laws on our books that govern how U.S. military assistance is to be used and is not to be used, right? There's an Arms Export Control Act that dates back to the 1970s that governs the use of U.S. weapons and says that they should not be used by people who are involved in systematic human rights abuses. You have, of course, the Leahy Law, which is, you know, much more recent than that, but is also, based on the same premise that U.S. military assistance should not be going to military units that are implicated in gross abuses of human rights. And it sets up a investigatory mechanism to ensure that, recipients of U.S. military assistance are held accountable to that standard. And the state of Israel receives the single largest chunk of U.S. military financing from the U.S. military financing program to the tune of, $3.8 billion a year. This is money for Israeli weapons that U.S. taxpayers are just handing out for free. Okay, this is not just the Israelis buying weapons from the United States with their own money. This is us literally buying the guns for them, giving them the money to buy the weapons to shoot the people who were killed yesterday. That's already in violation of our laws, right? There needs to be a political will to begin, holding them accountable to those standards. That has not happened. And that, I think, is something that needs to happen, because unfortunately, you know, if the Israelis think that they have a blank check to do this, they're going to continue doing it time and again. And the events that we saw yesterday are not new, right? We have been seeing this for 70 years. Palestinians have been shot trying to return to their land since 1948 by the Israeli military. Yesterday was just the most recent episode of this. And I would also mention, because there are many people who will, you know, raise concern about the notion that, you know, Israel is a state that the United States needs to support and it needs military aid and what have you. The reality is Israel is one of the strongest militaries in the region. It is the largest per capita nuclear state in the world. And it is an arms exporter to the tune of $9 billion a year. Why are we American taxpayers handing Israelis a handout of $3.8 billion a year to use to go kill Palestinians when, number one, we have laws on our books that oppose that, and number two, not only do they not need it, but they're making money off of selling weapons to other people around the world? It's something that should outrage us.
Yeah, and give us a sense of just what kind of traction this has in Congress, because my sense is not a lot because of the nature of our of American politics.
Well, I think that used to be true. I think it's starting to change. You know, I think previously many people were of the opinion that, you know, Israel needed support from the United States. They were not particularly aware of what Israel was doing to the Palestinians with the military aid that the United States was giving them. But I think over the last 15 to 20 years, particularly as the Israelis have carried out some of the more horrific campaigns, including, you know, aerial bombardments for weeks in Lebanon and in Gaza repeatedly, that perception has really started to change. You know, this idea that Israel is a David facing a Goliath has really begun to be inverted. And I think people are realizing, as they saw yesterday, when you have Palestinians who at most have, you know, rocks or things that they could throw being shot by snipers from hundreds of meters away, that the power imbalance is significantly different than what they have imagined. And we're starting to see opinions change. And I think they will eventually change on the Hill. It's a matter of time. But I think anyone who knows how Capitol Hill works, particularly on these issues, will understand that that will be the last place where right. where this ultimately changes.
All right. Well, give me your sense of what are the implications of the move of the embassy? I mean, what are the implications? You know, how is this? Nikki Haley was arguing in front of the UN that you know, this violence is not a function of the move of the embassy, and on some level, I think she might have somewhat of a point, right? Because the violence has been ongoing since prior to this. But how much? I mean, what does the move of the embassy signify? Both sort of like in this narrow sense, temporally, but also more broadly.
Yeah, I think she's right about that much. This isn't directly related to the embassy as much. I mean, the main reason that this happened was because there was an order given to fire at protesters. Right. And those protests are not new. And they have been going on now for weeks. And they were supposed to culminate around this period of time, because this is when Palestinians mark what is known as Nakba Day, a day that marks the depopulation of Palestine, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, of the vast majority of its native inhabitants. You know, this was something that was planned for some period of time. What I do think is important, though, is that the decision, you know, not just to move the embassy, but also to move the embassy and open it on this particular date, a date which, you know, regardless to what your position is on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, it should be clear to any impartial observer that this is a date that is, you know, one that both Israelis and Palestinians look at in extremely different ways. And for the United States to make the decision that they did to move the embassy and to open it with fanfare in Jerusalem on a day where Palestinians, you know, mark a tragedy of ethnic cleansing, is to deliberately rub salt in the wounds of a occupied people who are to this day struggling for freedom. And I don't think that that is something that will be forgotten, particularly as we watch the images coming out of the region yesterday with officials in the American government smiling, clapping, singing alongside officials of the Israeli government who had given the orders to the Israeli military snipers to fire at protesters, 60 of whom were killed just a few miles away. That's something that's not lost on Palestinians. That's something that's not lost on people in the region, and I don't think it will be forgotten by people of conscience around the world.
I want to get to sort of you know, what where we go from here. But before we do that, you mentioned that today marks the Nakba, and I mentioned earlier to folks that we had a filmmaker on, I guess, several years ago now. In his The Great Book Robbery is an interesting documentary that details at least what Palestinian society was like leading up to the Nakba. But you on Twitter were sharing your family's story, and if you wouldn't mind, you know, retelling that, because I don't think that there's a broad understanding in this country that there are stories, you know, like your family's, that there was a Palestinian society that was forcibly removed, involving, you know, you mentioned the deadly marches. Just tell us briefly, if you will, the story of your, I guess it was great-great-grandparents.
Yeah, it's the story of my maternal grandfather, actually. And, you know, if people are interested, they can check out the hashtag My Nakba Story. Nakba is spelled N-A-K-B-A. My Nakba Story. And Palestinians are, you know, using the opportunity to tell the stories of their families and what they went through, precisely because, as you mentioned, people don't really know. And there's unfortunately this very dangerous myth that, you know, Palestinians never existed, that the society never existed, that their entire peoplehood is a function of imagination. And, you know, that is a very, very sort of insidious myth, because it enables a lot of what's being done to Palestinians today. It enables the continuation of the Nakba through this day. And so I thought it was important for people to just understand what that meant, you know, to my family in particular, as part of a personal and individual story, to help them connect with what was really a massive scale event from in 1948. And so, you know, my grandparents were living at the time in a town called Ramleh, and the neighboring town was besieged by Israeli military units in July of 1948. Massacres were committed there, including when a artillery weapon was fired into a mosque where hundreds of refugees were seeking shelter. And that entire town was forcibly ethnically cleansed. Seeing that, the people in the neighboring town decided to leave under the threat of a similar fate, and they were evacuated from, you know, the outskirts of the town. What had happened to my grandparents, though, is when they got to the evacuation spot, they were told they were no longer taking refugees. And so they were forced to go back to the town that the vast majority of their family had now been forced to flee from. And they became what's called internally displaced people, internally displaced persons. They were essentially refugees, but not living in the home that they were from. And they ended up living in what became a ghetto, a small part of the old town of the city that had been ghettoized by the Israeli military. And the home that my grandfather had built and bought had become occupied by Jewish settlers who took it over in the short period of time after he left. And for 20 years, my grandfather lived in this ghetto. Was able to walk down the road and see other people living in his house. And it was many years later when he was able to get an order from a local judge to be able to return to his house, but only after he bought out the current tenant who had never bought the house to begin with. So effectively, to simply live in his own house, my grandfather had to buy it twice. And, you know, this is just our own, you know, personal experience with the Nakba, what it meant for our family. For the vast majority of Palestinians, you know, they never had an opportunity to return in any way. And they are still waiting to this day to return to the land that they're from, that they're born in, that their grandparents are buried in. You know, we often take for granted the fact that at the end of the day, most of us, the vast majority of people in the world, they do the same thing. They go home. But Palestinians have not been able to go home for 70 years. That's what they're protesting over.
You said, what, did you know your grandfather? Was he alive when you were you know, old enough to talk to him about that? I'm just curious as to what, I mean, I can only imagine I personally, if I had to go through something like that, would be consumed with anger, frankly. I mean, I'm just curious as to what your sense is of what your, how your grandfather dealt with that.
Yeah. And I was fortunate to know him for, you know, a number of years in my youth before he ultimately passed. But obviously it's, you know, it's enraging, but, you know, for Palestinians who remained inside Israel after the Nakba, you know, you were no longer living in a Palestinian society. Now you were living in an Israeli society where the state itself viewed you as a threat because you were Palestinian. Just by virtue of your existence as a Palestinian, you were referred to as a demographic threat. And so, you know, despite the anger, you remain a targeted minority. And even though you can pass your stories on to your family, the constant discrimination, the constant marginalization is something that obviously, you know, prevents many Palestinians in Israel from, you know, demanding their rights. That continues to this day. It's an experience that many Palestinians now, what, 1.8 million Palestinians inside Israel share.
So what, where do we go from here? I mean, you know, I mean, give me your sense of, I guess, both in the context of Israel and Palestine, where we go from here, and in terms of American politics. I think there's also something very unique about what has taken place in the past couple of days. At least that's my sense in terms of just sort of the awareness, the understanding of how of this dynamic, and part of it, I think, at least domestic to the United States, is a function of Trump in a sort of sad way. But in terms of with the Israelis and the Palestinians, like what, where can this possibly go other than this sort of stasis?
Right. Well, you know, I think between Israelis and Palestinians, the power imbalance is so dramatic that, you know, it's very hard to see how the situation is going to change internally. I think it's only if something from the outside compels it to change, that it will change. And, you know, the vast majority of Americans, close to, 70%, routinely say when they are polled that they want the United States to play an even-handed role in the Israeli-Palestinian issue. So that sentiment is definitely there, I think, among Americans. The problem, of course, is that the United States is not playing that role. The United States is deeply, deeply complicit in the oppression of Palestinians through their support of the Israeli government. And so I think what needs to happen is a demand for accountability and a demand to end that complicity by working to change the policies of our government to, you know, actually be even-handed, or at least stop putting your, weight on the side of the scales of the Israelis, who are already, far, far more powerful than the Palestinians. As I said, we finance this. You and me, our tax dollars, we make this possible. We have a say in where our tax dollars go, and we can do something about it. And so, because the United States has essentially failed to change its position on this, what we've seen emerge is a civil society movement internationally, although started from Palestine, to call for civil society boycotts, divestments and sanctions, much along the lines of the divestment movement that helped pressure the apartheid regime in South Africa and bring it down, to press the state of Israel to end its denial of Palestinian rights. And so that's something that we are deeply involved in, and I would encourage all of your listeners to look into and get involved in as well.
And so to the extent that we can have any influence, I understand that. But in when we talk about the Israelis and the Palestinians, the idea is, the two-state solution seems, I think, it seems to have basically that idea has gone, it's run its course, that no one seems to think that is plausible now. We're pushing for the United States to use its influence to the extent that it can, or to at least take its thumb off the scale, with the hopes that Palestinians get full citizenship rights in Israel. Is that the idea, or is that almost too hard to sort of strategically map out?
So, at the end of 2016, you'll remember that at the end of the Obama administration, there was a resolution in the United Nations Security Council. And afterwards, the Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, delivered a very lengthy speech about the United States' perspective on the conflict. And he made clear that the two-state solution is dying. I am of the camp that it was long dead. But he said if that option dies, then what we are dealing with is a situation on the ground where we have separate but unequal, which is, of course, something that Americans understand very well from our own history of injustice here. I think what the Trump administration has done is said, yeah, that's fine. That's fine with us. And they've given the Israelis a green light to keep going in that direction. I don't think that will last forever, obviously. I think there will be a day after the Trump administration, and I don't think that separate and unequal, a de facto apartheid system, is something that the world will tolerate in the 21st century. And so, regardless to what the political constellation is, Israelis and Palestinians are going to be living together in one way or another. It's a question of how they are going to live together. I think they can live together as equals before the law. And I think that's the only way that this can happen. I think that if they're not treated as equals before the law, though, which is the way the situation is now, there's no reason to expect that this conflict will ever end. And I think that over time, people in the United States, liberals in particularly, will look at this situation and continue to be reviled and disgusted by what they recognize as, something from a time in the United States where we knew we had to change. and they will call for change as well.
Yousef Mnayar of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, this show relies on you for its support. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It's dollars a week. Not even. Yeah, I guess a couple of dollars a week. For 5 days of programming. And as a way of saying thank you, as if that wasn't enough, we give you the fun half every single, almost, just about every single day. I mean, look, here, there, but almost every single day, extra content. If you're one of those people who do not have the financial means, but you really want the extra content, don't hesitate to email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. We will lock no one out of the program for money. But if you are one of those folks who are fortunate enough to not have any financial limitations when it comes to supporting media that you like and appreciate, then by all means, jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Today, as you know, is Tuesday, which means that it's the Michael Brooks Show day. And on the Michael Brooks Show today is...
What about Hamas? My opening commentary will be like, you didn't mention Hamas.
Bibi Netanyahu will be on.
Hamas, there was actually a crayon drawing in a children's book that said Jewish people weren't nice, so we needed to kill them all in Gaza. Alison Hartson, she's a Justice Democrat Senate candidate, and Bhaskar Sunkara.
And if Tuesday wasn't enough for you, then you can also listen to the Antifada. Go to patreon.com/TheAntifada. And Jamie, when's the next The Antifada coming out?
I believe it's coming out tomorrow. We also released a premium thing over the weekend. If anyone needs a little comic relief, you can listen to Sean torment me for about an hour by mansplaining the immortal science of Marxism, Rogerism, which is probably what you think it is.
That sounds great. Really, really good.
That is patreon.com/TheAntifada. All right, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Hey, folks, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off. And, hey, maybe you want to IM the show, or maybe you want to listen to the show on your smartphone technology live. Well, you can do so by picking up the app at majorityapp.com. We're in the middle of a redesign of the app, folks. Works for iOS and Android, and when we relaunch, it is going to be super sweet. So get it now so that you just get it updated. Believe me. Believe me.
It's going to be a great app.
All right. Quick break, then fun half.